Now, it's always neat to hear of farms that have been preserved with the same family over several generations. But is it still possible for a first-generation farmer to get started? Well, Ryan Bivens is proof that it is indeed still possible, but that doesn't mean it's easy, and there's definitely no one roadmap for success.
You know, and just because somebody says, oh, no, you can't do that, you know, go to the coffee shop in town and tell them, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. You'll have some naysayers. Like, oh, we did that years ago. It doesn't work. Try it yourself. Do it on a small basis. You have to figure out what can and cannot work for you. You can't break the bank doing it. If you're going to screw something up, do it on a small trial. Try it out there. And who's to say if it works, then next year expand it. You know, but you know what's best for your own souls.
First-generation farmer Ryan Bivens talks about his path to getting started in farming, why wheat is his favorite cover crop, and how he manages 88 different landlords in his area of central Kentucky. This is the Soil Sense Podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning in to Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down today with Kentucky farmer Ryan Bivens. Ryan farms in Hodgenville, Kentucky, which is in the central part of the state, just 2 miles from where Abraham Lincoln was born, their local claim to fame there. He grows soybeans, corn, and wheat on about 7,600 acres, 1,200 acres of which he owns, and the remaining he leases from 88 different landlords. Ryan grew up around agriculture and started farming once he joined FFA as a freshman in high school. But after college, his wife took an ag teaching job in the community they now live, so he had to essentially start over. He wasn't even sure if he could continue to farm, but he searched for farmland to rent through an ad in the local newspaper, which he's going to talk about here in just a minute. This was a really fun conversation about unique aspects of farming in central Kentucky, how Ryan got his start, his overall approaches to soil health, and a whole lot more. But it all starts in FFA, where a couple of big life changes happened for Ryan. He started farming, and he met the girl who would become his wife.
I started as an FFA project. Had worked up by my senior year in college, I was farming about 500 acres. My wife took this job. I knew things were getting serious with us. And it was like, you know, all right, so it's time to make your move here. You know, you're going to have to delegate the rest of your life. And I was prepared to give up farming because I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go get a job because obviously, you know, family and all that is going to come first. And ran an ad in the local paper where we were moving to that just said something along the lines of ambitious young farmer looking for a start. I had one guy, I think it was like 4 weeks I ran the ad. Had one guy that up and called me, and he was just kind of being, I don't want to say nosy, but curious, you know, want to talk to this guy and explain to him what I was wanting to do and looking for crop ground to lease, and met with him and personally, you know, became good friends with him. He was one of these guys that, you know, he was looking to get a little bit more than what the going rate was in town, but he also offered me amenities that I didn't have, like a building to work out of as kind of a shop, a little bit of grain storage and that kind of stuff. So there were some perks there. So I took that on. And then, of course, word started spreading. And in our community, there was a whole lot of beef cattle raised in the community at the time. There was a lot of pasture ground, a lot of hay fields. So a lot of the ground we've picked up since then, that was in 2002. So let's say this is our 21st crop we've put out in this area. We've transitioned done a lot of bulldozing, took fences out and, you know, turned a bunch of pasture ground and hay fields over into crop ground. We're 100% no-till. We're in rolling hills of central Kentucky, so you don't go in and work a bunch of dirt. And it's just one of those things, and it kind of blossomed from there. You know, and I tell people all the time, I try to live by the golden rule. You treat people the way you want to be treated. And that's how we do our landlords. I'd rather lose a dollar and be able to put my head down on the pillow at night than sit there and worry that I've cheated somebody out of something. So,
wow, so let's talk about these landlords. You said you have 88 that you're working with, and you're 100% no-till. Do your practices play into the relationship you have with the landlords, your ability to accumulate some acres?
Well, as I mentioned, all landlords are different. You have to listen to them, see what do they want. You know, there's some of them, all they're worried about is a check. Let's face it, they want top dollar. There are some that we lease from that, you know, the family has owned the farm for many generations. They want to see it taken care of. So, you know, I think that does play into some of it, that, you know, how we treat the farm, how we treat the soil. And, you know, I remember those first few years, I've always prided myself that I've tried not to take a farm away from another farmer that was currently renting it. Now, if that landlord is not happy with the farmer and there's going to be a change, yeah, I'm going to be interested in it. But, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily a deciding factor a lot of times. You know, at the end of the day, most time it boils down to money, but there's other things that go along too. You know, you gotta treat, and I don't want to share all my trade secrets, but you got to treat them. You got to listen to what they want and go from there. You know, so yes, taking care of the ground, you know, we try to have good looking crops. You do like anybody else would. I always tell people, I treat my rented land just like I do the ground we owned. It's just as important to me because I can't make a living on just ground we own. We have to have other farms. We have to rent ground. You know, and these landlords, my largest landlord owns 1,300 acres. My smallest one, probably 5. You know, it might be 3 or 4 5-acre tracts that are beside each other. We make one field out of. But you got to work with them. You got to listen to them, what they want. I've got several landlords. I wouldn't know them if they walked up to me. I've talked to them on the phone. I've got a lady in California that I've never met. But we've talked on the phone many times. You know, it's just, I don't know. That's something that's missing in today's society. I think we've gotten away from actual communications because of all the electronics. And here we are doing an interview over the phone, but you know, all of our communications, the electronics we have today, you know, we've gotten away from face-to-face conversations. And that's hard for some people to do. And, you know, and it's just, I don't know. My wife tells me all the time, I've never met a stranger, I guess. So there's a, maybe that's my downfall in life, but I think that's something that's helped an awful lot also.
So can you walk us through what it looks like in Kentucky? I'm thinking of in North Dakota here, we've got huge expanses of land. Like what is an average field size?
It's not like North Dakota. So in Kentucky, it's very rolling, first of all, but you may drive, I don't know, there's spots we have fields that we might leave a field that we have and drive 3 miles until we see the next crop field. And then there's other spots we farm where you have ground that's, you know, right there close together. You may open up into a, I don't want to call it a valley, but just kind of an area that opens up. There's a lot of ground right there, but then you may drive a couple more miles and then there's another big area that opens up. So we have a lot of woodland, a lot of hills, hollers, as we call them in Kentucky. That's probably not a word you use in North Dakota often, but I don't know. Like I said, it's a gentle rolling terrain. It's home to me. I absolutely love it here. I think I get bored. I'd like to try flat land sometimes, but at the same time, I think I get bored with it at times also.
And what type of, you know, soil related challenges come with that? Obviously, with the hills, you got to worry about erosion. But just curious about when it comes to like improving soil health in your area, what comes top of mind?
So where we're at in Kentucky, we're very heavy clay based soils. We've been really fortunate this summer. We've had an abundance of water. Mother Nature has really helped. Very little irrigation. We do have a little bit of crop under pivot. 300 acres of our crops under pivot, and we haven't turned the pivots on the first time. That's what kind of rainfall we've had this year. But also, I tell people, we're always about 2 weeks away from a drought. If we go 2 weeks without rain, we start to suffer. So if you back up to 30, 40 years ago, when there was a lot of tillage work done before no-till was really popular as it is today, you couldn't farm a lot of the ground we farm today because of the rolling. Soil erosion would have been something absolutely terrible. You might have farmed the top of a hill, but you wouldn't have thought about farming the slopes around the hill and all that also. You know, so there's a lot of ground we farm today that if you had to go back to working that ground or tilling the soil, that you wouldn't be able to farm it. You know, we do a little bit of tillage at times just to try to smooth up a place if we have something. We pick up a new farm and it's a little rough. We'll try to go in and work it and level it and smooth it out. And, you know, we raise a lot of winter wheat. So soft red winter wheat is what we raise. So we double crop all those acres. So our rotation is about 50-50. So we'll be 50% corn, 50% soybeans. About half to two-thirds of our soybeans are double crop soybeans behind that winter wheat. So we'll go in as soon as we harvest the wheat, no-till right into that standing stubble, plant double crop soybeans. At times, highly intensive management wheat, we're spraying it a lot of times. Wheat is a 12-month year job, I tell people. When everybody else is taking off in the wintertime and getting stuff prepared, we're up there spraying wheat and applying fertilizer, which we use controlled traffic, same tracks over and over. But it doesn't matter if it's muddy or if it just has rain, you've got to go when it's time to go with wheat. So, you know, we do have problems with tracks at times. So we'll go in and correct some of those problems and kind of smooth them out and fix that at times. So we do just a little bit of tillage, but I like to tell everybody we're basically 100% no-till.
Do you have room in there with all that double cropping to use cover crops? Or what does that part of your program look like?
So we do use some cover crops as well. Our ground is highly variable in Kentucky where we're at. you know, it's nothing uncommon to take and have a 30-acre field that has 10 soil types across it. And you may have a deep red clay, bright red clay in that spot, but you go off over to the other side of the field and it might be a gray, black, mucky, wet-looking soil there that you deal with. So we do lay drainage tile in spots. We very little pattern tiling here. We'll go in and tile spots. Of course, a lot of our foundation of our soils around here, we're not far away from Mammoth Cave. We have cave system underneath of us, so sinkholes are an issue. We have a limestone bedrock basis, you know, for foundation under our soils. So with that being said, most of the time, some of our ground that's more of the wetter type, we don't run many cover crops on them because it's so hard to get it to dry out in the springtime. Ground that's not in our wheat rotation, we will use cover crops. There's a lot of cover crops in our area. A lot of people don't like to raise wheat. I love raising wheat. This year was not as fun. Like, give you an example, for during wheat harvest, from the first day we cut wheat to the day we finished, we had somewhere between 12 to 15 inches of rain. And that does not go well with wheat harvest. So sometimes wheat harvest can be a challenge. And this was an odd year for that. But cover crops do play in. I tell people all the time, everybody gets excited about cover crops. I'm like, we have been raising cover crops for many years before cover crops were that buzzword or that hot topic that everybody wants to talk about. Ours were a cash crop, you know, and one of the reasons we raise a lot of the wheat is we see the benefits of what wheat does for our soils in this area. I tell people all the time, I could chart out corn yields. You know, obviously corn is king. We all know that. You'd ask about any farmer in the country, they're in a corn-soybean rotation, and corn is king. But with that being said, I say all along, I can chart my corn yields, and they're doing much better in that ground that's got that wheat in the rotation with it rather than just a corn-soybean rotation. But I will say this, I've never been able to mimic what I can do with growing a wheat crop with cover crops. So that's been a challenge for us.
Can you talk more about that? What is it that the wheat's doing?
First of all, one of the things you see, the tilth in the soil is just unbelievable. When you walk out in the spring of the year, you can reach down and pick up a handful of the, you know, topsoil, and it's almost like potting soil. We don't bale any straw, so we chop the straw, blow it all back into the, just blow it out on the ground. For one, we don't like the nutrient removal that we have with removing straw off the ground. But the other thing, I mean, it's amazing. The anaerobic activity we're getting there, you know, from everything chewing on that straw. Straw breaks down so much easier. If you think about the size of a piece of wheat straw versus like a corn stalk, it's going to break down so much quicker. And I mean, it's amazing what it has done to our soils, you know. And also with that, we've got a mat now of stuff laying on top of the ground that we can go in and no-till through. And sometimes creates a challenge because it can stay slimy underneath that mat. But at the same time, if we can get through planting through that mat and get a stand established, it's like we've got a carpet there that is holding moisture in all summer instead of the sun baking out the moisture of it.
What about for weed control? You know, does having that third crop in rotation really help you with your management?
It certainly does. I think people are learning with cover crops. That's one of the benefits of cover crops that we never thought about years ago was weed control. But with wheat, you know, as thick as... Well, we just harvested our best wheat crop ever, and we're somewhere around 110 bushel acre average. When you have wheat that thick across the ground, it's going to smother weeds out. And what we've seen happen is now when we go back in, so we've planted soybeans behind this wheat crop we just harvested. We'll harvest them sometime in November. Come April, we have very little green vegetation growing in that field when it's time to plant corn. So, you know, it has really helped with weed management. Some of the farms that we have more of our weed problems on, we try to get them into a wheat rotation. But at the same time, you need good, I guess, well-drained ground to grow wheat in that rotation and be successful at it. So that makes it a challenge sometimes. And maybe that's part of our problem with cover crops. We have not put our cover crops in the most ideal conditions because obviously we're going to put our wheat on our better ground at times, more well-drained ground. So, you know, cover crops, they certainly work. Do they work for everybody? No, nothing works for everybody. You know, it's just like me trying to tell a guy in the Midwest that he needs to be no-tilling everything. I don't understand his soils. And I've said that to a lot of my fellow farmers out there that, you know, we can't tell each other how to farm. There's not one right way or wrong way to do it. Everybody has to know their own land. They have to know their soils and they have to know what works for them. If I don't go out and learn something every day, that's the day I need to hang it up and quit, because that's the day when, you know, you're done as far as I'm concerned.
I'm curious, if you were to see an, you probably wouldn't see an ad in the paper these days, you probably see something on Facebook, but if you saw that same ad that you put out there however long ago, what would your response be to that young, ambitious farmer?
It was funny. At the time, you know, I was 22 years old, straight out of college. seed corn companies for years, they'd always put a sign next to the road that said what variety it was. Someone had some signs made up that said another quality crop by Bivens Farms. They put my phone number on the bottom, put them in front of the crops we had that year. I actually picked up two farms the next year because of those signs, people that saw it. But I could go like to the local store, McDonald's, where the coffee club always gathered, and I'd hear them talking about me because they were expecting somebody 40, 50 years old. They weren't expecting this young kid in town. You know, in their defense, I would have probably been the same way if it was somebody that had come to where I had been all of my life, you know, and all of a sudden there's this, the new kid in town. You know, you're always going to have questions about it, you know, but I laugh at it all the time. I tell people one of these days, I'm going to write a book about it, but I try to be very open-minded. You know, you look at the facts of the average age of the farmer, how old we're getting, the number of farmers we lose every year. You know, I don't want to farm at all. I don't like farming the acres we farm sometime, but it's kind of like the Walmart philosophy. You don't have small mom-and-pop shops in these rural communities anymore. You've got Walmart, and we've got Walmart supercenters and stuff like that. You know, farms are going to continue to grow. There's room for everybody. You know, I've told people all along, 20 years ago, I was very hungry. I'd knock on doors. I'd stop and ask a question. I might have a business card I'd pass out. But it's got the point. You think about the age of farmers. You know, the average age is around 60, I think. You put 20 years on them. What's going to happen to that? There's going to be a lot of ground turnover. There's going to be plenty for everybody to go around and farm. And, you know, so I probably don't get as upset about that as I once did, you know, but looking back, I go back to when I first did that. I completely understand where all those local farmers felt at the time, because I'd have been the same way. Like, you know, who the hell's this new kid in town? What's he think he's trying to accomplish? You know, he doesn't have no right to do this. And, you know, so it's like I said, it's kind of funny now. Some of them even kid me occasionally about it. You know, they look back at it and think, yeah, that young buck coming to town and said, we talked to him, tried to be nice to him. Boy, if we had to do it, we'd shut him down. We wouldn't have helped him one bit at all. So we all have a good laugh about it occasionally.
How long did it take you, Ryan, to get your first owned acreage? How long in your farming career before that became an option for you?
I guess it was our second year in. We had an opportunity, 75 acres to buy, sold at auction. I didn't go to auction. Somebody else bought the auction. They were just wanting to resell it and make some money. And they called me and asked me if I'd be interested. And, you know, I'd say it was just a good average piece of ground. Didn't have anything on it. They wanted $1,650 an acre for it. And I remember going to the bank and, you know, this was right at 20 years ago, going to the bank and a local banker, he was one of the guys that had bought it. And I said, well, you're going to have to loan me the money. He said, I'll loan you the money. I want the loan. I remember leaving there that day, and I think my payment worked out to be like $125 a tillable acre. And I thought to myself, how am I going to make this work? You know, this is back in $1.90 corn, $6 soybean days. And you thought, how in the world will this ever happen? Well, now I pay more than that for, you know, a year's cash lease on an acre of ground. So, you know, all things in perspective. But one thing in common, I've heard a lot of people over the years, a lot of older farmers, you know, you try to listen. I've heard them all talk about, I wish I took more chances. I wish I'd have bought, you know, more ground when I had an opportunity. And I can say that myself. You know, I've seen ground now, you know, $1,650 an acre ground, maybe bringing $15,000 an acre now. A lot of $10,000 an acre ground, you know, and it's just, it's a shoulda, coulda, woulda, you know, hindsight's 2020, however you want to say it. So obviously if a chance comes up, I've took a lot of chances in life. And like I said, I've been very blessed. Most of them have worked out up to this point. So
how does technology play into the management of that high dollar land? What are you doing to make sure that you're keeping your fertility up, but also your costs down?
Well, it would be nice if we could buy an acre of land and get that acre to pay for itself. That doesn't happen. I've always said it takes two or three rented acres to help justify that one acre you own. We just bought some more ground here this past spring, and we were just in a position because of the land base we have put together, the rented acres, and, you know, we're in a position to purchase that. Technology-wise, you know, I go back and I don't look at if it's the farm we just bought, if it's the farm we've owned for 20 years. I treat them all the same, you know, or in an aspect. We want the most maximum potential out of each one of those farms. So we do a lot of grid sampling. We soil sample every other year right now in front of corn. We feel a soil sample is good for 2 years in a row. But I think it comes down to having your system put in place. I've got my system of how I apply fertilizer on corn. You know, we'll oftentimes fine tune it, but we've got that system that we have figured out that works for us. And we may try something else. You know, I remember take back 15 years ago when I was just learning, all these salesmen would come out and say, oh my God, we've got this product here. It's going to put 10 bushels on your bottom line. You know, if I did all that, I ought to be raising 1,000 bushel corn and 500 bushel soybeans, but it doesn't happen. You've got to be smart about things. You know, we'll try some on a small acreage, try some different things. We do a lot of trials every year, but we figure out what works. And a lot of time, if a farm, you know, you pick up a new farm. Let's just use this for example. Farms we bought this year. Of course, I know a little bit of history because I've drove past these farms. I knew them. We'll go in there and kind of do something like an old standby on a hybrid or a variety of soybeans that we put on those farms first. There's something we know that's proven. We may not go out there and just pull the, I don't know, that new latest and greatest out and throw it on there. But, you know, obviously soil testing is very important. You know, one of the things that I think people take for granted oftentimes is pH. We will throw the N, P, and K to it, but we don't look at that pH. And lime is such a cheap additive you can put to the ground. We have very good quality of lime here in central Kentucky because of our, you know, limestone-based bedrock, you know, that's mined out. So, you know, that's one of the things I find more interesting than anything is a lot of times when we picked up a farm, the pH would be way off. And you've got to keep that pH balanced. You know, if you don't do that, your nutrients are not going to work for you. I tell people all the time, we do a lot of tour groups here on the farm. A lot of non-farm public will have come through and, you know, they want to see and talk to us because an oddity of our farm, we market, we're right here in the bourbon area, bourbon trail area. So all of our corn goes to the distillery market. So that's a cool story we can tell. Anywhere in the world we go, everybody knows what bourbon is. And I can point at a bottle on the shelf and say, you know, we grow corn, it goes into that bottle. So we have a lot of tour groups come through a lot of times, you know, people want to stop and talk. And one thing I tell them all the time, I said, you know, this may sound weird, but it's so cool for me to take a plant. I can take that one little bitty seed and put it in the ground in the spring. And I maybe got 50 opportunities to do this in my lifetime. Put that seed in the ground and I'm going to nurture it. I'm going to care for it just like somebody would a child. I want to know what its needs are. I want to try to give it everything to make it return to its maximum potential to grow more seeds. And people will really look at you funny like that because it's like, you know, well, it's not a living, breathing. Yes, it is. A plant's a living, breathing thing, just like an animal or a child or anything else. We have to care for it. It's one of those things, you know, you have to pay attention to the details. When it comes to technology, of course, we're using all kinds of GPS technology. You know, take a planter and we're dropping seeds on top of seeds that, you know, they actually become weeds because they're competing against each other for nutrients and sunlight and all that. So I think that's probably one of the biggest things that has changed is technology. Plus, we've seen such a great improvement in hybrids. 2016, we had a pretty rough year. 2012 was a bad year for us. We had a lot of heat and we made probably 80 bushel corn that year, whereas we've got a lot of farms that have well over a 200 bushel APH on them. You know, so it was a bad year, but I've laughed and said, you know, if we'd have had 1980 genetics in 2012, we probably wouldn't have had 20 bushels that year, if that. So technology certainly has changed and it's helped us out tremendously.
This is great. I mean, I feel like every time you answer a question, we find that something else interesting about you, from, you know, farming on caves to, you know, growing corn for distilleries. It's really, really cool. You did say something earlier that I wanted to go back to, which is the residue, you know, the residue from the wheat and kind of managing that. It sounded like maybe it took some fine tuning to get that just right. Can you maybe talk about your approach to making sure that you do get the good stand, you know, planting into that wheat stubble?
You know, it's, and this is so funny to say this because farmers hate change, but part of farming is you have to be willing to adapt and change. And sometimes that is on the go. One of the hardest things, you know, I talk about wheat harvest and we're going in and planting double crop soybeans into 100 plus bushel standing straw. A lot of times we're harvesting wheat at a higher moisture. So, you know, 20 to 25% moisture. That straw is green. It can make for some challenges. You know, we've had to learn to run aggressive row cleaners. But even that in the spring, you know, after we harvest our double crop beans this fall, we put all that residue back out on the ground. You know, it starts there at the combine. You got to spread it evenly. You got a good level spread. But you take, if we get into a wet spring and it stays wet underneath there, you know, one of the things we've had to do, and it maybe would have considered it years ago a rescue mission, but vertical tillage tools. You know, we may have to go in and kind of chop and size that residue. But we try not to do that because we learned this the hard way one year. We had all this great mat of straw down, you know, going into plant corn. And I thought, this is going to be great. We're going to conserve moisture all year. It's going to hold moisture in. Going with row cleaners, we cleaned out our path. We planted a crop of corn. Next thing you know, we have fluffed up each side of that corn plant, the straw. Well, then we get a high wind. And a corn plant coming out of the ground is the laziest thing there ever was. I mean, it gets one little straw laying across and it's just going to fold over and go back down. Whereas a soybean can have all that stuff and it's going to push itself on through. So, you know, that's one of the things we've had to learn. It's been a learning process along the way, but I'm seeing the returns now. You know, and I talked about how much rain we had this year. We've learned that there's times that our soils may be a little more forgiving on moisture wise because we've got so much tilth built in with all this residue in there as well now. You know, about the time we think we're learning and we're figuring out how to do this, something else comes along. You know, we run into a problem this spring. We love the fact of those fields that aren't in a wheat rotation, putting a cover crop on them, going in. We've held the soil all winter, so we have no surface erosion whatsoever. We've sprayed it. It's beautiful. You know, we're going to go straight in and no-till it. Now, all of a sudden, we've got slugs. So we have fought slugs, getting soybean stand. We had one soybean field this year we planted three times because slugs just kept eating them up. We're having problems with voles in our area, which are like a little bit bigger field mouse. You know, they're inhabiting these areas. So now we've had to go back into some of these spots and run a deep inline ripper that's not going to disturb the soil much, just try to rip apart their colony. We've quit shooting coyotes. You know, coyote populations have been thick over the years. We'd always shoot coyotes because they'd go after cats and dogs, you know, pets. My boys have 100 laying hens. They sell eggs to all the neighbors. They have a refrigerator here in our office. It's the shop that, you know, it's on the honor system. They come in, but we have to deal with them eating their chickens. So we'd always shoot coyotes around. Well, we've learned we have to quit shooting coyotes because they work in that system and they're controlling the voles. They're controlling groundhogs. Those things that we have not seen for several years, all of a sudden that coyote population, we start getting it under control. Well, then we have a population of other varmints coming up. One more thing we've had to learn the hard way. So
I'm curious with your cover crop mixes, since you rely so much on winter wheat as a cover crop, how do you model those mixes after what you see with wheat?
Well, first of all, a lot of people will talk about, and even our university, they'll talk about annual ryegrass. That just makes me cringe because that does not work with wheat in your rotation because it's hard to control annual ryegrass. We run a lot of cereal rye. We've tried radishes before. Crimson clovers, they all work nice. The problem is we have such a long growing window. And we try to take advantage of that growing window with, you know, longer maturing hybrids and varieties of soybeans that without going in and trying to do some type of interseeding, whether it be aerial application, that's something we're going to try this year. We're going to do some with applying some smaller stuff with a drone. Cereal rye has been one we have found that really is beneficial. I do like the crimson clover mixed in with it. You know, it's got to a point, though, I don't think I can mimic. I think part of the reason the wheat does so well is we're taking it all the way to full maturity. We're not getting as thick of a crop with cereal rye. Obviously, if you've got cereal rye that thick, you go to try to take the stuff to maturity, you could have a train wreck real quick. That's one thing I laugh at people that talk about all these cover crops. You need to do this. I'm like, yeah, you got to manage cover crops because if you don't, you can have a bigger train wreck than what you had without the cover crop there. You know, so I think that's one of the things we've learned how to manage the wheat crop. We know what we're doing with it, or think we do. You know, maybe we're not there with the cover crop issue yet. You know, I don't know. Like I said, everything's learning is about learning in agriculture. We've got to be willing to change. You know, every year we'll try a little bit of something else. Cereal rye is something else that has worked very well for us. It all depends on what our weather does. You know, the great thing about Kentucky weather, if you don't like it today, we've always said wait a day and it may change. Because we may be harvesting soybeans in November and have 80-degree weather this week, and next week it may be 25 and, you know, trying to halfway spit snow or something. So you never know what you're going to have here. So that's what it all depends on is, you know, what kind of growing season are we going to have in throughout those winter months to allow those cover crops to grow and do their job.
This has been so great, Ryan. Really appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, we have too. I could read Abby's nonverbals of when she's really into a conversation and when she's not. And I guarantee you she's enjoying this one. And I know I am too. You know, we usually just ask though at the end, you know, think about the audience that we have, which is mostly farmers who are at varying points in looking at soil health. Maybe one's never tried a cover crop. Maybe one's full tillage. Maybe they're about where you are, or maybe they're even, you know, completely cover crops and biostrip till and, you know, varying levels on sort of the soil health journey. If you could give one message to them, sort of your TED talk to this farmer group, you know, what would be your message?
Well, I think what all farmers have to keep in mind, and it's not just with cover crops, it's not with anything. You are the one that knows your farm and your soils the best. You know what they need. You have to be careful. That's the salesman, we built a farm office on a main highway a few years back. And I've told people that's probably the worst thing we ever did, because now I get every salesman, you know, it doesn't matter what they're selling, whether they're selling soap or selling seed or whatever, they stop in there. They see this, oh, it's this big white building. We're going to stop in there and sell some of these guys. And I've been innocent. You know, there's been days I've bought stuff just to get them out of here. But you have to know what works best for you. And that comes with trial and error and learning. You know, and just because somebody says, oh, no, you can't do that, you know, go to the coffee shop in town and tell them, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. You'll have some naysayers. Like, oh, we did that years ago. It doesn't work. Try it yourself. Do it on a small basis. You have to figure out what can and cannot work for you. You can't break the bank doing it. At the end of the day, you know, us as farmers, we want to produce a safe and abundant supply of whatever it is we're growing. We want it to be safe, whether it's in the food system, textile industry, or fuel system, whatever it is. We want to do the best job we can. And I tell people all the time, I'm a first-generation farmer. My number one goal in life is I want my two boys, my 15-year-old and 12-year-old, I've tried to teach them to have the same love of agriculture that I have. I want them to be the second generation. So why am I going to do something to screw up the soul that makes my living for them? You know, farmers, yeah, there's bad apples out there. Every industry has bad apples. Obviously, you know, we all could probably drive around multiple states and we could probably eventually find that one bad apple. But as a whole, all of us in agriculture, all of us in farmers, we care about our ground. We care about our souls. We want to see what's done best. You know, if you're going to screw something up, do it on a small trial. Try it out there. And who's to say if it works, then next year expand it. You know, but you know what's best for your own souls.
Well, a great message right there to end on. Thank you very much to Ryan Bivens for joining us on the show today. And he's right. There's no one way to do all this stuff. And that's why we want to share these various stories of farmers working with different approaches on different land in different contexts to build healthier soils and the practices they're using to adapt to their local conditions. So thank you very much to Ryan. It's nice to have a first generation farmer on the show. And of course, a lot of great insights there from him. Well, before we close, I would like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayouette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. Now, if you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe to and follow this show on your favorite podcast app, and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website, which is just farmersforsoilhealth.com. And until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.